really bad cold, if you had flu, would you come to church? You wouldn't come to church. Because probably you're not feeling too great. But I expect there's another consideration in your minds as well. It might be a slight barrier to fellowship. I mean, sometimes I've had to come along when I'm not feeling 100%. And I won't shake your hand, and I'll try and isolate myself a little bit. What we don't want is for other people to go through what we're going through. We want to care about other people, don't we? But generally speaking, if you've got a bad cold, best place is bed, really. Go home, go to bed, have a Lemsip, and get over it, or something like that. And then we can come out. Well, it's not quite the same, but certainly as we look in verses 32 to 33, there are clearly some issues here in this community that would give rise to a similar sort of response. Things going on in their lives that would give them the same impulse to submit themselves to a regulation, a kind of a practice, a code of practice that would cause them to withdraw, separate themselves, to isolate themselves for a certain period, and at the end of that kind of come back into the full flow of things and come back into society and get out amongst people again with thanksgiving and a recognition that God has been good to them. And that's basically the outworking of it all. And if you go back to the beginning of passage, maybe in verse 4, this thing I mentioned about the cold, you see, obviously the uncleanness, the thing that causes uncleanness, affects you first and foremost, doesn't it? It's you that's suffering. You're the one that's going through one of these kind of life experiences. But it doesn't just affect you, does it? You're the epicenter of the experience. But beyond that, it also affects your relationships, doesn't it? It affects people around you. There's a potential, like these people, if they touch somebody else, or there's something, they make contact with something that makes contact with something, it's going to affect other people around them. So there's a concern for others here. And beyond that as well, it's not just them, it's or their relationships, it's the environment. It seems that all these conditions are affecting the environment, the immediate environment in which they're inhabiting. In other words, there are times where people are in a state where relationships have to be temporarily curtailed, where people have to withdraw, where they have to be separate, because it, wherever they go, whatever they do, affects the people around them negatively, affects the environment around them negatively. They spoil the party. You know, everybody's just carrying on fine, and then somebody turns up, and you can see from the color of their nose and the red around their eyes, you know, you're really pleased to see them. But, I'd like to love you from a distance, if I may. Because actually, you could really spoil a good thing just by being there, just by being around. Right there and then, we wouldn't put it like this, but we treat the situation as if this is dirty. It's like dirt. We have a similar reaction to it, don't we, to dirt. We eschew it. We withdraw from it. We try and avoid that kind of point of contact. So the person who's going through something is like a pebble thrown into the pond. That's the situation they're experiencing, and it goes around, and it's affecting people all around them. The important thing about this is that this state of uncleanness is not just something that affects you. You know, people say, let's transfer this for a moment to, we're not talking about moral uncleanness. There are things that people do, attitudes that people harbor, okay, that are primarily just consume them. But when you're around them, you know, you pick up on it, don't you? Sure enough, fast enough, and it affects the whole environment, doesn't it? Certain people, they walk in a room, it's not the person, it's the kind of, the attitudes or the convictions or the way they go about things. They come into a room and it creates this kind of effect. And everybody has to kind of deal with it. And the fact is that people say, I can do what I like and I can live how I like and I can be the person I want to be. And yes, in one sense, that's absolutely true. But the idea that that's just a private choice that only affects you, that's nonsense. The way you live your life, the way we live our life, affects the people around us. It affects our environment. We make a difference. Human beings count. We count. So that is something that we're sort of seeing. There's a pattern of that here. In other words, the refusal to withdraw, the refusal to go away and get the matter sorted out before coming back, actually there's a moral side to it. It's actually immoral to impose your whatever it is that causes negative consequences on others, to impose that on other people. It's what you call antisocial behavior, isn't it? When people just don't care about the people around them. They don't care what they do. They don't care how it affects them. They don't care how it trashes the environment all around them. They won't get the matter solved. They won't get the matter sorted out. They're just carrying on. And these regulations here are all about isolating those situations. You know, if people won't voluntarily kind of have the sense or the concern or the compassion to deal with it, there are regulations here in place to sort of, if necessary, insist. But I want to say this, because I've kind of gone off on a tangent, because I've been talked about sort of moral evils. And the truth is that the things we're reading about in this passage, there isn't one single moral evil in this passage, is there? There's not one thing that's been this discharge or the emission of semen or the woman's menstrual cycle. None of those things are in and of themselves moral evils. Well, there's nothing morally evil about any of those things. They're just quite neutral. It's just nature. It's just part of life. All those things are just part of life. I suppose if we're getting down to the detail, this discharge in the first section, they're talking about discharge. If we had to put a name to it, if we were going to call in the medical authority to try and put it, I suppose actually we're just talking about somebody who's got a case of diarrhea, aren't we? It's very unpleasant. It's very unpleasant. I think that's what it is. I think that's what we're talking about here. And that absorbs the first 15 chapters. You know, anybody who has any work, you know, if you're suffering from that, you're not supposed to go into work, right? 24 hours, 48 hours. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, there's nothing particularly strange about these regulations. We recognize the wisdom and the sense of it, and here we find it in the scriptures. But I don't think you realize these regulations and our practices, our ordinary practices of life, are very different from the way lots of people in the world live and the rules and the regulations they live by, the way we take for life. It hasn't just dropped out. Well, I suppose it has kind of dropped out of the sky. The wisdom of God has been given to us, hasn't actually? Much of our society is orientated around what we've learned from the scriptures. We probably wouldn't live the way we lived unless our culture and society was influenced by the word. And the regulations about semen there, 16 to 18, 19 to 30, about periods, there they are. It's as if these really quite ordinary things, because actually, I remember the first time I thought about this is that, I said this would be a bit earthy tonight, but diarrhea is a wonderful and amazing reflex of the human body, because it detects toxins or bacteria invading the system and so pulls the release hatch, removing all the proteins from the body in order to make sure that the bacteria have nothing to thrive on, to give the body the best chance of the immediate recovery. It's genius. It's fantastic. And the human reproductive process that's described here in both the male and the female forms here, again, if you give any time or thought or consideration to it, the ovary cycle and all these sort of things, and the means and mechanism of the male discharge, it is remarkable. It's wonderful. It's clearly God, isn't it? Right? So these things are in and of themselves actually rather remarkable and rather wonderful. And they were all there in the garden. Those facilities were there in the human body in the garden before the fall. But it seems that as a consequence of the fall, those things which were, you know, like there's benign and malign tumors, aren't there? And you've got a growth. And actually, the doctor has a look at it, and you're fine. It's not a threat. It's just a little growth. But notice how often the doctors will remove that growth or seek to remove that growth because of the concern of what it might become. That it might mutate, those cells might mutate, and you might end up with a malign tumor. And that's something you don't want. You don't want that level of toxicity and danger in your body. And it seems that these perfectly ordinary things in life are being ring-fenced in the scriptures here. As if somehow there's an inherent danger that these perfectly ordinary and good things could become malign. That somehow the consequence of the fall has changed this world in such a way that even good things can corrupt and become dangerous. And so it becomes necessary to do something about it. They're quite natural things. Sin, actually, is a natural thing, isn't it? Yes? I mean, it is hardwired into every single person in this room's nature. Hardwired. Is that fair to say? Original sin. Human nature. Fallen human nature. It's natural. I mean, it's not original to us, you could say, because of there was something that was almost like that was benign in human beings at the beginning. But as a consequence of the fall, it has corrupted and it has become malign and has to be isolated. It has to be dealt with in some way because of its potential. Most people sin. Let's face it. Everybody is a sinner. Every single person out here is a sinner. And most of the time, you could have a good chat, have a laugh, go to work, come and go, drive a car, have a family. I mean, you don't see sin as some great big overflowing cauldron of corruption. It's not some malign, toxic monster most of the time. Most people are just carrying on ordinary lives. But they're all carriers, if you will, of sin. And just like these perfectly ordinary situations we've been reading out here, it all seems quite natural. Life just seems to naturally carry on. And yet the Bible is serious about sin. Just in the same way as it seems to be serious about this, because there's a potential here that God is drawing our attention to. These people are suffering these various experiences. Well, I wouldn't even say suffering. They're going through these life experiences here. They're not grievously affected by it. I mean, you know, whether it's the periodic cycle or whatever, it affects you for a week. That's what it's saying here in the scriptures. It's only a week. You know, you're unclean for a little bit, then it clears up and you're away. If you touch somebody, it doesn't ruin their life. It just affects them for a day. They have to wash their clothes. It's not a big deal. It's temporary. You can wash your clothes. You can go to the temple and you can make an offering. You can be restored into fellowship. It's not the end of the world. The cup that needs to get broken because of your contact with it, it's only a little clay pot. You can go and buy another one. It's not the end of the world. There are little things. These are little things. It seems in lots of ways that this is not a big deal. And the sacrifices that you have to offer at the end, two birds, that's probably less meat than half a chicken. We're not talking about a huge and costly sacrifice here. The whole thing is really quite light. It's just nature needs to be in some way ring-fenced around. It's not a big deal. It's a little disruption to people's ordinary lives. Most people are washing their clothes anyway. Most people are changing their bedclothes and their clothes anyway. Most people are trying to keep clean anyway. You just have to do it a little bit more if that's what you're going through. I think I told you I went to a boarding school. And at my boarding school, if you had a lesson you really didn't want to go to, and you thought to yourself, what I'll do is feeling very well, you know, and start to do one of these. We had a matron at our school, and I think she should play for the Lions, because she was terrifying. And I tell you, it made you want to go even to your worst math class. Because being put in, yeah, there's a sick room, and you had to go to this sick room. And in this sick room, if you were, whatever it was, you just got put in this sick room. It was white walls, white sheets, White, everything was white, yet a plastic cup. There was nothing stimulated, nothing interesting, nothing appetizing in that room at all. You got so bored. You got so bored, you'd rather suffer a maths class than sit in that room and try and throw a sickie, unless you were really ill, in which case it was a very good and safe place to be. But a little bit, that's all we're talking about here. Most of these things, it's a little temporary bit of isolation, isn't it? Okay, let me take it up again. Look at verse 31. Why, if it's all so natural and sensible and modest and logical and all that sort of thing, why in verse 31 does it seem you must keep the Israelites separate from the things that make them unclean so they will not die in their uncleanness? Why are you suddenly starting talking about death? Why are you blowing the trumpet and sounding the alarm? Why, when we're talking about something that's really quite ordinary, are you now ratcheting up and you're talking about something that is potentially fatal? How could this destroy your life? How could this wipe you off the face of the planet? Why is this actually a lot more serious than it immediately appears? Let me just say, I mean, these are fairly obvious statements to make, but diarrhea, do you know what the number one cause of infant mortality in Africa is? It's diarrhea. Diarrhea. Simple diarrhea. Okay? Easily treated. Easily treated. This is going to 2,000 children every single day. Diarrhea. Horrifying. Horrifying statistics. Basic lack of sanitation. Basic lack of hygiene. Fundamental. Not rocket science. The sort of stuff we all take for granted. Availability of clean water. And the ordinary means of rehydration. Yeah? It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. And they are dying in their thousands and their hundreds of thousands. And the Africa of today, in terms of its technological development, I think is probably more analogous, isn't it, to the period of time that we're reading about, Israel in the wilderness in Egypt, you know, 3,500 years ago, the kind of conditions they were living in. I think this basic conditions that we all take for granted, the fact is, sadly, if we get a condition like that, hopefully in a few days' time, we're better again, back to work, and life carries on. There you die. There you die. And suddenly we realize why these very ordinary looking things, God is saying, lest you die. And his concern for us is much more deep. It may not seem much to us, but God understands. God understands how serious the situation might be. Dysentery, even in Europe here, dysentery, which is an extended form of diarrhea basically, isn't it? In the 19th century, the Europeans were going to war with each other all the time. Honestly, it's like we were addicted to war. We were going to war all the time. More soldiers died of diarrhea than they did in combat. The number one fear of the soldier in the 19th century, Lord, please let me not get diarrhea, because that is a long, painful, agonizing death. I'd rather get a musket wound and it's all over. So actually, these situations are a little bit more complicated than that. And of course, although the body is wonderful and the discharges from our body is a wonderful mechanism, if you don't understand sanitation, the presence of those discharges is an absolute magnet for bacteria, because it's just a great big heap of protein waiting, and the bacteria just... And of course, the conditions multiply and the diseases spread. And before you know it, you have an epidemic on your hand. You are experiencing a plague. And we take it for granted what such incredible, healthy lives we live. People at 70 are off going, walking the Great Wall in China. You're young at 70, it's the new 50 or whatever it is. But for lots of people in the world, life expectancy is 30, 40, 50 years, maybe. And they suffer terrible ravages. If we're talking about blood as well, there's a whole section here, isn't there, about the woman and her discharge of blood. Anybody who's a bacteriologist, who studies bacteria, will know that you take a Petri dish and you want to get some bacteria and you want to multiply bacteria. You want to show how quickly bacteria accelerates. And of course, you've got to give it some food. The number one thing, what do you put in that Petri dish? You put blood in there. There is possibly no better vehicle for carrying the necessary proteins on which bacteria thrive. It is bacteria hotel blood. It's fine while it's in your body. But as soon as it's coming out, and if it's not dealt with and cleansed and dealt with properly, you become a magnet for infection. A magnet for infection. So, and the same, I have to say, is true of semen as well. It's exactly the same. It's a high protein solution. Fine in its proper place. Outside of that proper place, bacteria will thrive on that environment. Bacteria will thrive. I remember one of the phenomenal things about, I've visited once or twice into the deserts of this world. I've been down to the Sinai Desert. I've been down into the Arabian Desert. And you can be in the middle of nowhere. There's absolutely nothing to see. No animals, hardly a scrub or a shrub anywhere to be seen. But if you've got a little bit of something on your mouth or you've cut your thing, somehow, some way, there's flies. Where do they come from? I have no idea. Out in the middle of nowhere, there's flies and they can smell blood. And those little critters, they carry on their little feet. Every foul and evil thing. And they fly them around and travel it around. Can you see that these situations, these conditions, these people living close to each other, if they don't do something about these conditions, and they don't do something fast, and they don't do something serious, they are going to die. And they're going to die in their thousands and their thousands, and they won't know what has hit them. No wonder the Bible says that the devil, one of the names of the devil in the Bible is Beelzebub. Do you know what that means? Do you know the translation of the word Beelzebub? Lord of the flies. The Lord of the flies. You need to stay clean. You need to be clean. And here, this is just dealing with things that are morally quite neutral. How much more, then, do we still need to stay clean when it comes to things that are morally negative? When it comes to sin. When it comes to sin. Now, I've been saying that basically all these regulations are essentially to do with the worship of God, and that this book is not the sort of Old Testament version of the NHS. But what is said here is that out of the cult of Yahweh, the followers of Yahweh, the worship of Yahweh, who is the God who saves, it's not surprising that from the God who saves come laws and ways that preserve the life that he has loved. Why would he save you only just to leave you vulnerable? He saves you and then he keeps you, doesn't he? He doesn't just save you once and then you're on your own. He saves you. Now walk in his ways and you will arrive at the destination which he has set out for you. And if they fail to do that, plagues will break out amongst them. Remember what happened in Egypt when the Egyptians would not listen to God? What did they experience? Plagues. Do you think it's God's will then that his people should then just die by plagues out of the wilderness? No. Listen to the word of the Lord and don't just be saved. Stay saved. Stay safe and stay in his love. In the moral law, it says you shall not kill. On the opposite side of you shall not kill is love your neighbor as yourself. If I want to not kill you, if I want to not hate you, if I want to not do you any harm, the only way I can do that practically is by positively determining to do you good I've actually got to do something in your interest to promote your health and your welfare. That's how I can not hate you. That's how I can love you, is by doing you good. So, this has been a long way around. That's why we don't come with a streaming cold to church, isn't it? Because we're doing something positive. We're loving people. We're actually saying, yeah, I'd really like a bit of company this evening. I'd love to go to church. I'd love to go and hear God's word tonight. But I'm not going to. I'm going to listen to something on the computer at home because I love the people I'm in fellowship with and I don't want them to go through what I'm going through. It's a positive act, isn't it? So the evil in this passage, chapter 15, is not the actual experiences. The evil is the failure to do anything about them. That's where the problems start. When you start to care more about yourself than you care about the other people, and you just don't put yourself to bed, as you should, for everybody's sake, as well as your own. Now, most people are pretty good about this sort of thing. Look in chapter 15, verse 25. Sometimes, however, sometimes sin, the human condition, which is mostly contained in a relatively contained situation, gets out of control. And relatively ordinary things go wild. And here it raises that situation, chapter 15, verse 25. Here's somebody who, instead of the ordinary flow of blood just continuing for a few days and then it all clears up and then it's over, it goes on. And it goes on. And a week becomes three. And you get a bit concerned. And a month's passed. And you're still keeping yourself and isolating yourself and washing your clothes and doing everything you know to do. And that's been 3 months. And your family are concerned and people are coming around, but they can't touch you. They can't really interact with you that much. It's a rather dangerous situation. People got different ideas how they can help you. Maybe you should try this, or maybe it's an evil spirit. I don't know what kind of things people come up with. We'll pray for you. And then it's 3 months. And you're still bleeding. You're still a hazard. And then it's a year. And you're not better. And you're basically socially dislocated from everybody you know. And you're beginning to suffer the fatigue of isolation, the normal regime of contact and social warmth, a hug, a kiss, holding the children, sleeping in the same bed with your husband. And then it's 2 years. You're physically depleted. And you're not getting any better. And anxiety begins to crowd in and dominate the ordinary thoughts of your life. And the rest of the world seems to just be fading away from your thoughts. You're in your tent all the time. People have forgotten about you. They don't see you anymore. And whereas before they used to say, well, I wonder where someone is, they don't ask that question anymore. And then it's 3 years. And you know, there are people in hospital beds. And it goes on. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on, and it's on. 10 years. 10 years. 11 years. 12 years. What happens to a person when in that situation? When all they've got is the drudgery of the washing and their own company and this sort of handshake like that and the visits from the doctors. Give up hope. And all they really want in the whole wide world is just a hug. Just have a hug. Somebody to hold me. Just to make me feel human again for a moment. Think of the children in Bulgaria. Year after year after year, locked away and isolated, unloved, uncared for, forgotten. Handed over to professionals. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on. You know, that's what I'm saying. Sin is always present, but it doesn't always sort of explode in a destructive, evident sort of way that you can see its monstrousness. And sometimes people's lives just get completely enveloped. Sin just takes over their lives. Their lives are becoming misery, is becoming ruined. In a way, it's a bit like God. You can't always see God. You're not even aware necessarily that God is working and God is present. He is. Sometimes he just breaks out in wonderful and glorious ways. But there are people dying in their sins. Dying in their sins. And that's what this passage is talking about there in verse 31. You must keep the Israelites separate from the things that make them unclean so they will not die in their sins, die in their uncleanness. Separated, isolated, locked away. Not knowing the love of God. What might you do if you were in a situation like that? Would you be tempted to just say, I know I mustn't, I know I shouldn't, but I just want to go for a walk. I just want to remind myself what it's like just to walk through the town centre, to see the shops, to see the children playing. I won't touch them. I'll just go near the park. I'll stand apart and I'll watch the children playing. I'd love to remember what it smells like, what it feels like. I'll go for a walk. And maybe nobody will know that I'm ill. Maybe nobody will know that I'm unclean. And I can sort of be normal for a moment. Do you think that temptation might come to you? As the thing just goes on and on and on and on. Would you go and see somebody like that? Would you go and visit somebody who's ill and shut away and can't get out, who's going mad with her own thoughts, locked away with her? We're going to do, I mean, we've got a visiting team, haven't we, here at the church? It's a blessing. People get visits. It's important that people get visits. Chris here goes out and does evangelism, goes out onto the streets, visits people who are dead in their sins and their transgressions. And most of the time, we go to church, we come back again, our life goes on, the wonderful Christian life we have, our meals, our worship, our songs and stuff, and we pass all these people around us, and it's all quite normal, it's all quite natural. They're sinners, we're saints, and we love them at a distance. But would you visit them? Would you go and reach out a hand to them? Would you go and make contact? Because clearly from this, if you touch them, you yourself will become unclean. It will affect you. Some people, if you go and visit them in the hospital, they're really, really unwell. Do you know it is distressing? It can be wearying. It can be distressing. Nurses famously suffer from compassion fatigue. Because they care and they care and they visit and they go and they go. It can be distressing. It can be distressing to go out amongst the people on the streets who are hostile and separate. Sin has got such a grip on their lives. They cannot see the beauty of the Lord Jesus Christ. They cannot even perceive that there is a God and that he exists. And you talk to them and they can be hostile. They can be rude. They can be vulgar, provocative, angry. It doesn't leave you unchanged or unmarked. It's not a zero cost exercise. You will be affected. These people, they affect their environments. And if you walk into that environment, you will be affected yourself. You want to go out evangelism with Chris? Think about it. But that would be a choice, wouldn't it? You could sit and you can pray about it. Say, is this my call? Shall I go for it? And if you went for it, you could say, well, I'm counting the cost and I'm going to do it. What about those times when you don't have the choice? What about one of these people reaches out to you and they don't ask, may I? Can I? And suddenly you feel one of their hands on your life and they touch you and they want to make a demand of you. They want to feel human warmth. They want to find out what it's like. They reach out. And do you feel when these dirty people reach out to our clean lives, put their hands on us? Do we feel, I didn't give you permission to do that. I didn't allow you to come into my personal space. I didn't give you permission. Does it leave you feeling somehow like your boundaries have been transgressed? You feel a bit made unclean by the experience. Oh, that ghastly man, he said, That's clearly what we're reading about in verse 31. When these people, if they don't separate themselves and they try and come into God's sanctuary and they come into God's dwelling place, it has the same sort of effect. God, it's a defilement of that sacred place, that place of life and health and safety, that heaven on earth, that little heaven on earth. It's their presence spoils it. And it seems as if it's not just the natural health dangers. The biggest danger they have is that God himself will break out against them. And that their presence near, in his proximity, in his place. I've said this before, haven't I? You've got a better chance of standing barefoot on the face of the sun than standing in your sin in heaven. In your sin, while you're in your sin, you can never enter heaven. You cannot take your sin into heaven. It has to be dealt with. You will never get in through the door because heaven is holy and all that's there is holy. And if the moment that changes, it ceases to be what it is, it becomes a defiled place, a spoiled place, and God will never let his habitation be defiled. And thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people will go up to those gates and try and walk through those gates to seek a place, an eternal place of life and health, and they will be turned back. And the Bible is not exaggerating when it talks about wailing and gnashing of teeth. But then we read something amazing. Mark chapter 5, verse 25. Anybody knew I was going there? Phil did, long time ago. Sandy knew a long time ago. We all knew a long time ago. There is hope. There is hope. Should have got there earlier, maybe. A woman, been subject to bleeding 12 years. 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors, spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she just grew worse. And then she heard about Jesus. And then she heard about Jesus. She came up behind him in the crowd. She was breaking every rule in the book, wasn't she? Pressing through. Why was she out there? Because she heard about Jesus. Out through the crowd. She came up behind him in the crowd and she touched his cloak. She touched him. Didn't ask. She knew the effect. She knew the consequences. She knew what she was doing. She was defiling Jesus. Right? She was making him and everybody else unclean. This was punishable by death. She'd come out of her hiding place and her misery. One last hope. One hope. One chance. That maybe everything could change. She comes out. There's a big crowd. Crowds can turn nasty, can't they? She touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes. She wasn't thinking, I'll make him unclean. She was thinking, I will be healed. Because she'd heard about Jesus. She'd heard about Jesus. And immediately, her bleeding stopped. She felt it in her body that she was freed from her suffering. And once Jesus realized that the power had gone out of him, he turned around in the crowd and said, "Who has touched my clothes?" This is a very crucial moment. If Jesus is the justice of God incarnate, the justice of God incarnate, he will denounce her in front of the crowd and they will stone her to death. Because justice has to be done. The law has to be kept, and she has broken it in all its parts. But Jesus is not the justice of God incarnate. Jesus is the living mercy of God. There is a greater law, isn't there? There's a greater law than justice. It's the law of mercy. And she says, he says to her, "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you're asking who touched me?" Jesus kept looking around to see who'd done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear. You can see why she was afraid. She'd been caught. Caught. Her sins had found her out. And there she was in the gaze of Jesus, in the whole crowd all around her. Nobody would ever know what happened to her. She told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." So it seems that all the people in the world can't help you when you realize the effect and the consequences of your sin. You can talk to all the people in the world and get advice and counsel, and they can't help you. In fact, it just gets more and more intense. And in a way, you can't come straight to God either. You just can't go to God and say, "Here I am, now you've got to be good to me and heal me," and things like that. Why? You're a sinner. You've broken my laws. You've got no leverage, no rights with God. But she heard about Jesus. She heard about Jesus. And you see, he forgives her, doesn't he? And we know what it's like to be forgiven by him. You can come to Christ. If you come to Christ, he will save you. Won't he? He'll heal you. He'll restore you to God. You'll be cleansed. You'll be put right with him. You won't be unclean anymore. All that is over. You'll be free. You'll be forgiven. But the cost of it falls on him. He carries your sin. The price of that forgiveness is that he himself amasses and accrues the sin of the world. He takes your sin. He takes it upon himself. And the price of that sin is death. The death we should die. The justice we deserve. Jesus pays the price. The price of sin. Isn't Jesus wonderful? Isn't Jesus wonderful? God is wonderful, but he sent, this is how we know his love. Not just his justice, he sent his son. While we were still sinners, he died for us. And he's taken the burden. The atonement has been made. We're cleansed. Sadly, lots of people, they're just carrying on. It's natural. I just don't believe in God or whatever. It's natural enough. We get very comfortable with it because that's just the way of the world. Sometimes in examples like this, what's there, the truth is what's there, just gets blown out of all proportion. We see it as it really is, the situation as it really, really is. It's terrifying. It's terrifying. People face the wrath of God. It is terrifying. But if you've heard about Jesus, and you come to him, and you reach out to him, you can know the forgiveness of your sin. You can be put back right with God. The doors of the temple will open and you'll be welcomed in. Oh, wonderful. That's wonderful. Enough from me. Let's come to Jesus. Let's come to Jesus.